Hey guys, welcome back. Our guest today is Benita Roy. She's an author, philosopher, and teacher who's focusing on building greater capacities for human sense-making. She has a wealth of experience in working with groups, and in her work, she integrates cognitive science, phenomenology, and Qigong with emergent themes in transformative education, leadership, self-organization, and complexity science.
In part one of our interview, we talk about group processes, deconstructing the ego and shadow work in group settings. You'll find all the links and show notes for this episode at futurethinkers.org/118. Now let's dive into the interview.
Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova. So Benita, welcome. Thanks for joining us. This is we've been watching a lot of your content lately, so we're excited to be talking to you today.
Yeah, and you know, congratulations. I feel like I'm a little bit part of your family now.
Yeah. Yeah, we were just talking before we started, like we don't know what to do with with our kid when we do these podcast episodes. We've got nowhere to put him. So, if you hear some squawking in this episode, then it's not Yuvi, it's the baby.
Yeah, it's not always me.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's an example. So, my first question for you is, how do you deal with the tendency of groups to get trapped in this never-ending cycle of creation and deconstruction of personal and interpersonal problems?
So I don't go there directly. One of the things that I've noticed, well, it depends like what situation. So I already created a scenario in my head. So it's different if I know that sometimes you guys actually have courses. That's different than if you're doing group process, right? Because when you have a course, you become more of, I have knowledge, I'm going to give you some, suggestions. Whereas when you're truly doing the group process, you're inside the culture itself. And so everything you say is up for deconstruction by the group, right? So the scenario I'm going to answer in is when you're actually trying to participate in the group process itself. And one of the things is, I tend to, I don't think you should go there directly. I don't think you should point out that someone's ego's talking or point out, I've always had this problem with the traditions because they keep yelling at the ego. And every time you talk to the ego, you're actually reifying it. So a lot of group process has to do with performance. We're always trying to avoid performative contradiction. You know, so for example, we don't want our ego, obviously, to yell at an ego, but we also don't want to reify the ego by confronting it. And the question, so the question is then, who are you talking to? Who are you speaking with when your goal is to maybe dissolve some of the boundaries of the ego structure? And what are the kind of moves that you can do where, like a Tai Chi move where you are actually working with the forces that dissolve the ego itself? Like the ego is a stable structure under certain conditions, and it's not a stable structure under other conditions. And you're actually just trying to cultivate the conditions in which the ego is not a stable structure. And or what other type of self can someone anchor themselves in? But if you directly go to deconstructing the ego, I mean, you can do that. But I think you'll find that it can be very frustrating. That's kind of a meta view. Maybe you can make a more practical question out of that.
Yeah, actually, my question would be, do you have any direct tips for kind of bypassing the ego when it comes up or bringing it to someone's attention?
Okay, so first I have to imagine, what am I speaking with? I see the ego as energy arising, and then I say, what am I speaking with? If there's no ego, then it's not a structure, like what is arising that I'm trying to dance with? And I try to really visualize, not so much of a, image, but to enter in to the felt sense that there's something beyond or beneath There's something else that's happening in this dance. So I'm not even going there. It's like the whole approach, the ego comes to me as a sliding context. It's like, yes, I address that. Sometimes, I mean, there's 100 different ways your responses then become spontaneous. But like one time I was teaching and something, this one man who was quite aggressive, this young one guy, and then he just starts downloading on me and all this stuff is coming at me. And, you know, instead of addressing what he was saying, I was just like, wow, that's a lot of energy. And I just kind of sat back. I don't even know what he said. And I was like, wow, that energy really had to come out. So when he was finished, I said, do you feel better now? And at first he thought it was a joke question, but really, and then he reflected, he's like, yeah, I feel better now. You see, I wasn't bothered with what the construction the ego was making. I was trying to figure out, like, where is that coming from? What function is it serving in the organism? Trying to work at that level. And actually what came out of it is he reflected, he said, yeah. And then a little while later we had a break and he came back and he said, I know why that happened. You see, so if people have a reflexive aspect, the organism will be self-reflective, but under certain conditions, you create more potential for that. And under other conditions, you're actually reifying the very structures you're trying to dissolve. And, this is really tricky work, but I know that you guys have a lot of experience and you can kind of perhaps play around with that. I mean, that's one example. My own journey, I have to admit, was helped by training horses. Because when you train horses, a lot of energy, a lot of what can look like aggression or this or that, you know, you start, when you're a young trainer, you ask, why is that horse mad at me? Or why are they stubborn? Or why are this? And then you realize they don't have a story. There's just kind of the dance of energy. And sometimes the energy is pent up and sometimes it's confused or sometimes it's free flowing. And so even by the time I started training stallions, you know, really, you see all this energy coming at you and it's just energy, you know, people will project an egoic structure and story onto horses and then they resort to abusive techniques because they're fighting with a structure that's not there, that's not in the horse's experience. But I did a horse workshop once with a group of people who then some of them went right into group process. And this one woman was having a difficult time and her new boyfriend happened to be very there and very disruptive. And she was having a very difficult time. And then on the second day, she was like, wow, they're just horses. And she didn't mean it to dehumanize people. She was using what she had learned. And so, like, even this notion of the ego has to be deconstructed, these are stories that our egos make meaning out of other people, out of the energy of tensions. So you're actually caught in, you know, recombinant egoist stuff, you know? So that's how I've avoided it. I've tried not to even, if I don't see the ego in, yeah, I see the energy, I can tell it's a structure, I can feel that it's contraction, but I try not to speak to it or speak about it because it tends to reify that it's real, you know? Now that's different than when I'm actually doing courses on the I-Me-Mind complex, when it's online, how is it pre-constituted phenomenologically? Then we talk about it as a holistic system. And then we're actually talking about how it's constructed, how it arises naturally, and and we could talk about this maybe in very early childhood experience, how these primary schemas are primitive egos. And, you know, we can talk about it in a kind of instruction toward a way, toward instructive way. But in group process, I try not to shine a light on it, either positively or negatively. I just don't talk to it. I sit back and I try to say, what's arising here energetically, a felt sense? Or I don't even try to psychologize it, you know, like, oh, the ego's wounded, or, you know, because that's also a little bit, it's more subtle, but I try to kind of dance with the energy and visualize a spaciousness or a state where those energies are pleasant, and let myself speak from there, whatever comes out. Or maybe sometimes nothing comes out. A lot of times surprise, like, wow, where did that come from? Even that's an appropriate response, because you're just surprised. You're genuinely surprised, you know, like there's a spike in energy. Oh my God, you know? And then, kind of taking it from there.
So one thing I noticed at the beginning of the story that you were telling about the guy who kind of just downloaded all of that energy onto you, was the way you addressed it seemed to be, first of all, you seemed to have a knowledge of where it was coming from, and that it wasn't about the content of what he was talking about. It was more of the emotional center. And then it seemed like you only addressed the emotional part. And that stood out to me as a good technique, even though you didn't explicitly state it.
Yeah. So here I want to be a little pedantic and make a distinction we make in my courses. And that is the difference between affect, which is what the body's doing, and emotion. An emotion is a story on top of what the body's doing. So with this distinction, this semantic distinction, I wasn't paying attention to his emotion. I noticed that the body was doing something different. I mean, his literally physically outside and inside, and there was kind of a spike in energy happening. So one of the things we did when he came back, and he said, I think I know why that happened. And we had been working together for a while. He said, because I imported this story about what she was saying, and I was mad at the story. He let some energies that was like a little difficult. The woman did have some kind of emotional energy, and he made up a big story. The story was like, I guess I gave her more space than he thought I should have, because she was kind of a new, what she was kind of saying was new agey. So he had this story that I was being a favorite to him and not to her. And that's what he was fighting with. Nothing in the room. He was fighting with the story that was imported. See, his body got uncomfortable. And what the mind does is it serves up reasons for why you might be comfortable, right? It's evolved to say, you know, is it this? Is it that? And a lot of times those reasons are just these stories were so instoried. And so then he started fighting with the story instead of just paying attention to what the body was doing and processing that. So what I say about affects is they're just like everything else. They come and they go and they take the time they take, right? They're like the breath and the heartbeat. And if he had stayed at that level, it would have just been a rhythm in the space, right? But he jumped, the mind serves up a story. He didn't notice. He got into the story really fast. And then you have more than just the affect. You have kind of a vicious cycle between the story that then churns up the unpleasantry in the body. So it's that step. We try to do exercises in my course to try to get closer to the toggle when the feeling in your body toggles into a story, right? So you get better at noticing just before that happens, so you can deal with it at its origin. And that's an exercise that people can get very, very good at. I've done it, and then some people be like, wow, there's proto thoughts. I can tell even before it's a thought, the quality of the sensation starts to get a little bit like indigestion. And I know that that's going to turn into a thought. So I swallow it then at this really, you know, you can get really good at this. And so you see, everything I'm talking about will deconstruct the ego, but none of the practices talk about the ego. They just say, this is what happens. Can we notice that? Blah, 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 blah. You know, these are the conditions under which the structures are dissolved.
You know, one thing I'm noticing a lot in the group practices, and it happened quite a bit earlier on last year, and we've kind of accepted the conversation from that point, and I don't think we've really brought it up, but there's this question of when am I done processing my trauma? And especially in that group setting, like, when is it time to put that to bed, if that's even necessary, and then go out there in the world and do something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is a really good question. And so I'm going to use some of the language from Rhea Beck's system. You know, she says that there's a circle of presence where you're learning how to be present with each other, to not have so many triggers, not have your ego involved, not to have, you know, all these biases and all these inadequate ways of discourse and conversation. That's the circle of presence. How can we just be five people in a room and start from square one? You know, there is no square one. We all have all this baggage and all these preformed ideas and all this condition. But basically, she calls it the circle of presence. And we can argue, there is some argument that this is actually a skill that we're reclaiming from our past, that we actually used to know how to do this. It's hypothetical, but you do see that a lot of them are employing skills like ritual and some of these older structures to make this happen. So understanding that there's that one phase. And then she says, the purpose of the circle of presence is to be able to create a circle of creation where you are coming, what I call insight practice, where the group is coming up with insights and awareness and orientations and perspectives that were not held by anyone in that space before. And so your question is, have we done enough in the first phase to get to the second phase? Now, I think that some people, I don't think you have to do the first phase 100%. I think that some people have this ideal of people becoming, you know, 100% clean, and then we can get on to things. I think that's really a mistake. And the other reason why it's a mistake is because if you're spending too much time investigating your psyche as a group, the psyche will invent new territory as you explore. It's an infinite game. This is what the psyche does. So, you know, I know people who do internal family systems, and they're like, you know, and then the parts create parts inside themselves. And then they're mapping out this territory of, and so that's what the psyche does. The psyche is like a fission reactor. It creates early on in the child's life, it creates primary schemas and then internal working models and then the ego structure. And this is what the psyche does. So it can be endlessly recursive. So I think that there is a real phenomenon happening in some of these circles where especially in the West, we over-psychologize stuff. So where that's happening, it's the same with when a circle gets like, are you projecting or am I interjecting? Is that real? You know, and those kind of conversations are crazy. They're crazy to try to analyze because when the psyche is recursive, you have, you know, is it transference, a counter transference? You hear all this nonsense. Okay. So to take a strong stand on that, those are not beneficial performances to do in group space, I think is important. And so then the question is, you know, what are we envisioning as the fruition of this first phase? There comes a point in any group's life where you just say, what if we put this to a question or a real question or a real test or action in the world that both ups the ante, but also will give you some senses if that group's going to move. I think being very clear on what is the goal, what is the fruition of the first phase, what would that look like, what is the minimum adequacy you need, and the other thing is, I think that you can take a few people who have very good skills and bring them into a group where people don't, and as long as they're not exponentially exaggerating those skills, they can increase the capacity. So you can move, for example, yourselves into a group of experts who don't really have dialogical skills, but you can make a place for them in terms of their expertise and still have a productive session that's, and in this case, productive means you've solved a problem or moved a inquiry along, not solved everybody's trauma.
In one of your other interviews, you talked about sort of the three stages of development, and I'm not sure which model this is, but you talked about the first stage as people project everything outwards, like the problem is outside, out there. It's, yeah, you know, other people's crap, or I have to fix something in the world, I have to save people. It's all externally focused. Then something happens and then they realize, oh, actually all of this stuff is a projection of my internal state. And so then they start focusing on fixing their internal state and doing healing and constant navel gazing. And then the third stage is that they realize, oh, actually none of this is about me at all. And I'm completely inconsequential in this. I'm more of an instrument of something much larger. Yeah. I really love that framework. It's very simple, but it really illustrates something quite well.
Yeah. And so the people that spend too much time, you know, trying to heal their trauma, it's a kind of narcissism. You start to see there's a kind of narcissism, like that the whole point of the world is evolved so that you can heal your trauma. I also want to say something about trauma, and that is, with my new cohorts, we have to make the distinction, you know, there's an existential reality about being human. And not all of that existential pain is trauma. We have to be able to separate what is trauma from, you know, you have to individuate from your parents. It's very painful and it leaves memories and it has archetypes or has primary schema, and it's a process you have to go through, but that's not trauma. I mean, people, like, they want to hold on to it, like, I've been through primary school, I've been through a breakup with my boyfriend, like they just hold on to this like you know. Now there is real trauma, and the thing is, there are fabulous stories of people who've been through awful trauma, and they shine. They shine as people. And so this is kind of like when you're moving from the second phase to the third, you realize you've made the whole thing about you, you know? So yes, it feels great when you go into this subtle realm and you realize, like, if I work on myself, then my actual reality changes. But then you get mesmerized with that, and you start to think like that whole thing is about you, that your whole spiritual growth is about satisfying you, you know, or getting, cracking the code, I call it, you know, cracking the code so that now you're happy. And very few people move out of that phase. I have never been in a group that's been able to successfully move into the circle of creation, which I call collective insight practice, which is why I don't do group process, because I'm waiting to do collective insight practice. And I can in my students, I hear they're between this, some of them are between the second one and the third. And you can hear people say, they start to use phrases like, it's not about me, I'm an instrument, or spirit is working through me. You start to see that there's something that's coming through them. It's not something they have to do. And you start seeing, it's not like work I have to do on myself. It's work that is being asked of me, you know? And of course, people with severe trauma or shadows, that can be ugly. But in many cases, people are coming, you know, are moving through that second phase and realizing they're not finished, but it doesn't have to be achieved. You know, it was on, Joe Brewer was on your call. I don't know if he talked about this on your interview, but he talked about the difference between achievement problems and practice problems. You know, your psyche isn't something to be achieved, you know, achieve the perfect psyche. It's something to be continuously practiced through. So I have a question for you. I mean, we might as well go there. Like, what is the purpose? Why are we all so excited about group process at this time in history? What is the purpose? What are we seeing as the benefits? What are the claims we are making? You know, this is a question that I had when I first started in 2012. The claim was that this was happening in these group processes. You know, people were making claims of group enlightenment and all these things. And I started participating in them, and I didn't actually see that they were achieving the claims that they were making. And so that's maybe an interesting question.
You know,
not to make a bummer out of it, but.
Well, yeah, I think we don't claim a whole lot aside from the just being there is a community and there are people who are talking about these set of subjects and doing these set of practices, and maybe you might be interested in doing it. It's not like we're advertising enlightenment or something in the courses or the groups, although I think some of the work relates to that question. And we've especially been discussing a lot of the Jed McKenna books about spiritual enlightenment in the calls, which I think is interesting. But it's irrelevant, really. It's the community is kind of the sales focus, right? It's like, come in, meet like-minded people, that kind of thing. But there is transformational experiences that individuals are going through, I would say, within the groups that are just a matter of doing the work and doing the processes. Yeah. And it's a hell of a lot more individual work than group process work. I mean, the group seems to just be like, okay, you're not insane. I mean, you seem to be on the right track, and it's more of a confirmation of what most people seem to intuitively already understand when they're doing the individual work. That's really it.
Yeah.
I'll answer the other part of your question. Why is there sort of societally, why is there so much interest in group practice? And I don't know what the case is for other people, and I don't want to assume that it's the same. But to me, it seems that people are realizing that the sort of individualistic approach that was really popular in the previous decades, that there's something incomplete about it, that we need to relearn to relate to each other. And actually, it seems to me that a lot of these group practices are not inventing anything new. They're just rediscovering what people used to know how to do intuitively before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the questions are more sophisticated. Like, the questions we have about ourselves are more sophisticated. But the way the group can hold that is probably evolutionarily old and embedded in the human system. I like to look at these phases of group or community practice as asynchronous transformation of the individual. So that's asynchronous transformation, but it's coursing through everybody, right? So if you bleed out the time, you could conceivably experience as a simultaneous transformation. But it seems to at first have a synchronous kind of rhythm to it. And I think that's very helpful for people, because if you say, you know, it's a transformational circle, but it has this asynchronous rhythm, then people will still feel inside the circle and notice that there's different spotlights of transformation, little insights happening here and there that don't necessarily land with everyone. But if everyone wasn't participating, then that spotlight wouldn't have shined. Mm-hmm. I think that's a claim that this work can make.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
I've never really heard anyone talk specifically about the role of shadow work in group format. It seems to be, and I mean, the experience that we have with it is it does seem to be quite heavily individualistic, but there's something to circling that seems to, especially as people are watching something arise in each other and in themselves, it seems to point that there is shadow material. But as far as the practice of doing shadow work, is that, does that have a place in group dynamic?
Yeah, so I'm just gonna answer by talking about how I perhaps address shadow work. You know, one of the problems with some of these practices is they become like the whole notion of shadow work is already loaded.
Yeah.
You know, so then, so what I talk about is I like to look at. So when I come into group space, one of the things that I think is important is to de-emphasize the individual and look at it more in terms of the group is constantly shaping itself and shaping each other, right? Because this is kind of where we want people to understand. And so like when you enter a group space, so I'll talk about it like this. When you enter a public space, immediately you're going to adopt a certain persona. That's one word. It's going to shape you immediately. Like when people call a collective insight retreat here, just calling it is already shaping the people. It's bringing up questions. And so the thing is working itself. And this is, again, like, it's not about me, only about me. It's how do I respond to the process that's underway? And how is the process asking me to respond? Okay, so instead of saying you have shadow and you have to work on something, which, again, puts the spotlight not on the correct unit of inquiry. The unit of inquiry is this group and in this present moment. And so what I will say, you know, what we'll talk about is how I spend a lot of time talking about how in early childhood you have a me before you have an I. And the me is the way your parents look at you. You realize that you're an object for their perception and that what you do with that me changes your relationship to your caregivers. A little later on, you realize the me that your father sees, I just use old gendered stereotypes, is different than the me your mother sees. And you start to make primary schemas about gendered roles. And the me is online. And this becomes the social me, you know? So when we're in social space, we're always trying to pick from our little box of tools the object that's going to fit in the public sphere. So the way I work with that is if I'm facilitating a novice group, I'll say, you know, we'll all be sitting around, people will be saying something. And then I'll say, have you noticed there's a lot of stuff going on in your minds? There's like all this stuff going on in your minds. And then you have a gatekeeper that would never say that. Like there's a whole lot going on. And then there's the gatekeeper. Like, what is that gatekeeper? Like, what is its function? You know, let's look at the gatekeeper and, you know, or people be quiet and I'll tease them like, oh, you people are like, I know there's a lot going on there, you know. And so we notice that there's a whole lot going on that doesn't make out into public space. So we look at that. And then, we don't say you have to expose it or anything, but you're looking at how, what's under the hood here, and we all have it, you know? And so, so what's not making it has something to do with shadow, right? Now, some people might put it in that frame. So but I don't really, I try to be much more human about it. Like I say, I'll say something like, and I'm just picking from different experiences. I'll say something like, you know, people were in a pickle because you come to these groups and you want to be seen. I mean, everybody really wants to be seen, but everybody is terrified to be seen. So we hide. So, we put each other in pickles because, like, I'm mad at you because you can't see me or my mother or my partner, but I actually gatekeep who I am. And so how is it possible for me to be seen? So we just all start to talk about like how this thing functions, and it's okay. It's okay how it functions. We just need to become aware of how the thing functions. And yeah, so that's kind of, I have a different way of languaging, a different way of working in spaces than some of the other techniques out there.
It seems your responses come from this very embodied, like you're not looking at anything theoretically, and almost with my question, it's almost a very theoretical question that doesn't play out in the way that I framed the question. You know, it's interesting.
I know people who are really good coaches. They've been through like Landmark or Avatar. There's these programs. And they work a lot with shadow. And then I've worked with them, and they come to the point where this is very sophisticated, right? This very high level, where they realize, I help them realize that the shadow is just a structure you make up. So we're like, we make up a structure, the concept of shadow, and then we spend our whole lives trying to get rid of it. And I say, why make it up in the first place? Why take, I'm all about release complexity. Why take that first step? And that's where I think the leverage is. Like, so you have all these people going around in these groups talking about shadow. It's the actual step that is in the way. Yeah. I don't want to take that step.
Yeah, it's interesting how much pain is built up around the structure of having a past trauma to work through, whereas just looking at it without judgment often can just be enough. It is interesting how much people build up these structures in their mind before they're able to actually tackle them, or whatever you want to call it, deconstruct them.
Exactly. So like if that comes up in space, I'll say, if I'm being really playful, I'll say, shadow, where is it? Or I'll say, if you didn't have the concept of shadow, what would you be experiencing now?
Good question.
Well, and then I'll say, because that's what you're actually experiencing. Everything else is a thought. And is it helpful or is it not helpful? Mm-hmm. To me, that's all the work is. Literally, it's not easy, but that's all it is. Everything else is a hyper-complexification of professional skills that sells the price of the ticket.
Yeah.
So there. That's what
you
I really
need a mic
think.
Drop.
As a community, we have to, because, and this is to my answer to why is we so hyped up on this, is because it also has proliferated in an economic system where complexity and hyper-complexity and the illusion of the priestly professional class to do some direct work on yourself is part of what creates the demand and the interest. And so I'm not saying people do this consciously, but this is part of it. We need people that can release the complexity and do this level of facilitation. It doesn't mean, oh, people go, aha, yeah, of course. It's still hard, but you don't want, you want to be very, you, it's like you want to be a surgeon with a laser. You don't want to be a surgeon in the Confederate Army where they would take a, you know, a saw and cut off your leg. We want this technology to be like laser surgery, and we need people to really understand what works in these spaces and what just increases the complexity, infinite complexity of the human condition.
You know,
yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up, because yeah, this idea that you can get rid of the ego or should get rid of the ego or the shadow is so preposterous to me, because they are structures, you could say evolutionary structures, that have a function and they do something. And by trying to remove them is exactly like trying to sever your limb. It's mm-hmm. just, it's, even if it is possible, it's not useful or healthy. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that just allowing it and observing it and accepting it is a much healthier route. And, you know, if you have an infection in the hand, you just look at it and you deal with the infection rather than chopping off the whole hand.
you know, exactly. That does bring up something that I'm just noticing now about maybe a incoherence in definitions that we're using. Like when I hear you talk about what I would term as ego deconstruction, it aligns with my idea about it. But I think I'm using a term that is not clicking with you. Like it's something about the ego deconstruction thing. And I think UV as well, it's not really working for you. So what would you call it? Like this deconstruction of frameworks that make up your identity that aren't necessarily true. Just like we would say that's the shadow. You know, mm-hmm. what's the term if we're not going to use ego deconstruction?
Maybe I can answer it. In my case, it's just observing that something is a structure, because that in a way kind of makes it less sticky. When you can quiet the mind enough and just observe that it's doing something, like, oh, you know, it's engaging in this process, or it's like I have this feeling and then it triggers this thought. Oh, interesting. Just right. Observing that kind of makes it less, I don't know, makes it less have a, how would I describe it? Have less of a looping function.
Mm. Yeah. So I think that was a good reframe, because we can go off in all directions. So what I guess I'm pushing back against is problematizing the ego. And I think that's a little bit of what UV is saying. But I would say that it's important to understand, what do we mean by ego? What is like, what's under the hood? And, you know, there's egoism and ego. And so for example, I can talk about primary affect. So primary affect in my body is what if my heart rate goes up or goes down, what neurochemical soup I'm in, what my hormones are doing, what my blood pressure is doing, my proprioception, am I dizzy? You know, like some of my muscles are contracted, some are expanded. So there's something my body's doing, and this is not ego. It's pre-egoic potentials of basically a mammalian self. Okay. So I can put that aside. That's not what I mean by ego. And then, so what we call those affects. And then there's the perceptual system, you know, that which is just your what you see, hear, taste, smell, your body sensations, your proprioception. This, again, is part of your mammalian human-animal nature. That's not ego. So then what is ego, right? If those are pre-egoic, then what is ego? And so,
to me, it's always seemed like the storyteller that builds an identity and attempts to explain those things.
It's the story.
Yeah.
Ego is story. Yeah. This is why Suzanne Cook Greider's work, everybody that is researching ego development, they ask questions, their sentence completion test, because it's this kind of story you will tell. So what I teach is to notice how and when the story that mind serves up a story. You know, something's, your baby is crying, we get a little irritated and the mind serves up a story. I remember once being on a plane and this baby in front of me was literally way off the charts. Like, some people are blessed with very difficult children. And I could tell the parents, you know, she must have been about 2 years old. And I could tell the parents had figured out their program for when she was having tantrums. And I'm talking about livid screaming, like for 20, 30 minutes. And I watched myself go from like, those freaking parents, why don't they're bad parents, why don't they do something about it, to like, oh my God, this child is in such, so much pain, to like, that stupid child, I would muzzle it or something. And and I could see these stories just come up one after another, you know, kind of, you know, trying to give me some explanation or trying to suggest something I could do. And then once I realized that, I was just watching them come up and come up. And then slowly my body wasn't irritated. It was just noise. Like I was kind of like, oh, listen to the frequencies or something. And then, you know, the child calmed down and I have a feeling that like energetically, there's something that like, I was like, probably got caught into like energizing that energy or something, you know? And so literally the body just serves up all these, even when we're happy, you know, the body serves up this story like, oh, maybe you should spend more time with him. There's a story, right? You have fun. Oh, maybe you should spend some more time with him. And then you get in that story. And of course, you know where that story goes. The first little thought starts to build this whole story about your happily ever life, you know? And then you go to your friends and then you build more of that story. So then the question becomes like, you know, once you start working with a story, a couple of interesting things happens and you realize that you're tortured by the story, but there's a big part of you that doesn't want to live without one. You feel the mind will not be satisfied with, like, well, like if I said to someone, like I said before, like if you didn't have the concept of shadow, what would your experience be? And you realize like, well, I actually would be disappointed because there's not enough drama. And now you start to realize, oh, well, that's the function the story has in your life. It's kind of a drama. Cool. If you want to live like that, like, I mean, it's, maybe you need to watch more TV or something. But I don't problematize it. We want to understand, first of all, why the mind serves up stories. Are they profitable? Are they beneficial? And then if you notice that, yeah, actually, I like them, then you understand you're complicit with, that's why you keep generating them, because you're actually, something is satisfied by having the stories. And so a lot of people are in drama. I mean, kids do that. You know, when you're irritated with your sister when you're a kid, you kind of like poke to make a fight, and then it becomes a fight. And when you look back on it, or at the time, you realize, you talk about it as if you didn't want to fight, but energetically you wanted to get in a fight. And that's why you kind of provoked it, you know? And so you start to see there's some total of human condition is really fascinating, you know? And for us to understand it is more important than for us to fight with some of it. It's here the way it is.
That's a great distinction between deconstruction and just becoming aware. I'm glad you made that distinction, because I keep using the term ego deconstruction when it actually should be differentiated between those two.
Mm-hmm.
That's helpful.
It's more like ego, understanding what is the ego and how you can literally learn how to see how it, oh, there it is composing itself. Oh, there it is composing itself. Oh, ah, there's a story,
mm-hmm.
You know, yeah.
It seems to, the awareness part of it seems to relate to where the ego is actually necessary. Like, you don't want to deconstruct everything. You want to know where some elements are necessary. Like, I want my child to behave well in public and not disturb other people and that kind of thing. So there's this kind of egoic element to that of like, don't embarrass me, kid, which is actually kind of useful to help the kid behave properly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Or sometimes I'll see it. I'll see the story and I'll look at it and I'll say, even in group space, and I'm like, I'm just going with it. I just feel tugged. And sometimes that gives a lot of pushback, but then it turns out sometimes that pushback has been helpful to move things forward, you know? But if you can slow what is happening automatically down so you can see how it works, you have more choice. And then you do that for 5 or 6 years, and eventually what shows up is more helpful than not. Somehow you've shaped the way it works, so you don't have to be so vigilant. You know, the whole point is not to be like incredibly vigilant your whole life.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something here that I've been trying to pinpoint, and it's coming from experience. So I haven't figured out how to put words to it yet, but there's this thing of, actually, you know, it relates to what you said, when people enter into a group practice and they want to appear smart, they want to figure out where they rank against everyone mm-hmm. else in the group. So they want to project some ideal version of themselves. And there's something of that related to a desire to have an outcome be a certain way. I want to be mm-hmm. perceived a certain way. I want this call to work out a certain way. You know, a lot of it's due to do with ranking, but there's also just an attachment to results out there in the world, which to me mm-hmm. seems to be a basis for the ego storyteller thing. And I mm-hmm. haven't found much of a basis outside of that. It's like, that seems to be a center point that I'm...
Yeah.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on
that? So the ranking is the structure that your stories take, right? So we said the ego has to do with a story, but then you can notice that the stories you tend to, that there are some basic structures. Gurdjieff said that there's one mother structure beneath all the other structures. So you start to see that your stories are helpful, even the helpful ones. Whether they're helpful or not, they repeat a structure. So ranking is one of the structures. This was a big rod, this one really big. And one of the key signs, so there's basically six different structures. Ranking is one. The two biggest ones are ranking and belonging. Belonging, people with high belonging needs get very nervous when people rank because it seems like other people being excluded, they don't want to exclude. And rankers, it's an instinct. You walk into a room, maybe it's just a big conference and you're at dinner. You just look around and you sit with someone, and maybe it's not someone who presented, but it turned out to be the big kahuna. Like, you just have an instinct for the alpha or something, you know? And that's not a problem. I think these are typologies. They actually curiously map onto the six Buddha bodies. So that's kind of interesting. When you take on in Dzogchen, you take on one of those deities at the end of, you know, you find like what your kind of archetypal pattern is. But the key is when you're driven by a subtle sense of it's never enough. It's never enough. So people who are rankers, even though they achieve all kinds of things, they don't think they've achieved anything. And it's never enough. And so you become, first of all, neurotic, but, you know, you become aggressive and non-ethical almost in your pursuit of something that's not satiable. Belongers are the same way. They have so many friends and it's never enough. It's never enough. You know, they feel like they're worthless and nobody likes them. And from the outside, you're like, what? So it's not that the typology is bad. It's when it's driving you with the subtle sense that it's never enough. You never let yourself say, wow, I have a lot of friends and they stick by me. Or, wow, I've done a lot with my life. And, you know, I don't really like being on the circuit, but I'm chasing this invitation and that invitation and this. Why? Really? What's the real reason why? Because I don't think I've done enough. It's never enough. So the typology is not a problem, but the and then when you get rid of what's driving that, it's not enough. Then usually your life spreads out in a different way, and you make much more of a garden variety of choices rather than the same choice. So the way that works is the ego has stories. The stories, if you look at them, you'll see they're structured. There's a predominant structure that's unconsciously driving you to this sense of there's never enough. So it's a kind of neuroses.
To get the full episode, go to members.futurethinkers.org. For $5 a month, you'll get access to all of our full podcast episodes, unreleased material from past episodes, and occasional extra content from our courses, including guided meditations, lessons, and more. Plus, you'll be helping us keep the lights on. Thanks, and see you there.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.